Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the people who is doing an outsized job of chronicling different aspects of that war, many of which would otherwise not get the attention they deserve, is a good friend of this program, Richard Pollack. These days, he is a senior investigative reporter for the Daily Caller News Foundation. He has served in a number of important roles in the media in Washington, including as the bureau chief in Washington for PJ Media, as a Washington producer for Good Morning America, and as a senior producer for Fox News Sunday. You can find his writings these days in the investigative beat of the Daily Caller News Foundation, and he has been doing extraordinarily important work on that score very recently. We're delighted to catch up with him and chat about it a bit. Richard, thanks for joining us. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Listen, I want to talk about a topic that is now beginning, at last, to get traction. You've been on it. The Daily Caller has done incredibly important work as well. Talk to me about the Clinton team, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, John Podesta, their circle in the campaign, in the State Department, you know, sort of the enterprise, if you will, the foundation, not least. And what we've begun to uncover, in part thanks to your investigative reporting, about how they've paid to play and garnered millions in the course of various official and semi-official functions.
Well, of course, the Clinton Foundation is perhaps a model of what not to do in terms of the pay-to-play idea. That this was, in my opinion, looking at it, an organization ripe for corruption. And I think that there were corrupt practices that probably were undertaken in a variety of different ways. There's a number of different very disturbing issues. One, of course, is the fact that Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, approved the Russian takeover of 20% of our uranium when she was a sitting Secretary of State. We have John Podesta, who able to sit on a board of a high technology company with three Russians with close ties to Vladimir Putin and to the Kremlin. We have Bill Clinton receiving an extraordinary $500,000 for a single speech in Moscow. And then, of course, Hillary personally led a delegation of high technology Silicon Valley executives to the Silicon Valley of Russia to try to help their Silicon Valley. The entanglement between the Clintons and the Russian side of things is really amazing, and it's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, that last bit is really important, and it's not yet, I think, gotten the attention that it deserves. I want to just call particular attention to, with you, Richard Pollack, this so-called Skolkovo project was identified while the Clintons were engaged in promoting it as essentially an overt technology theft operation sponsored by, in effect, the U.S. government. I'm just astonished that that deal hasn't gotten more attention, but perhaps it will now that at last the lights are coming on. Do talk a little bit about your most recent report about John Podesta, longtime aide to the Clintons in the White House and on the campaign trail, and sort of the evidence that when they no longer were powerful, the pay-to-play scheme pretty much dried up.
Yes, it's very interesting. The company is a Bedford, Massachusetts company called Juul Unlimited. It is a green company, and for a lot of different reasons, basically on the basis of influence peddling, they decided to award a board seat to John Podesta. And he did it for 3 years. He sat on the board with three significant Russians. Most, I guess I was about to say most surprisingly, but it's not surprising at all. The company is in the renewable energy area and obviously had hoped that if there was a Hillary in the White House, they would be able to prosper. And of course, John Podesta would be in the White House as well. And what's very interesting is very quietly, almost secretly, the company closed its doors after the election. And I have quoted two senior executives. One's the CEO, and the other one was a Russian board member who confirmed that when Donald Trump was elected president, they realized they were not going to get the kind of governmental preferential treatment or subsidies or other kinds of mandates favorable to themselves. And so they closed their doors. They closed their doors because of the election of Donald Trump. And had Hillary been there, I think that they would be thriving today and probably putting out press releases about all sorts of expansion.
Yeah, presumably paying to play along the trail. I want to commend your former boss, the founder of the Daily Caller, Tucker Carlson, for a really illuminating conversation that he had with Richard Goodstein on his program on Fox last night, in which he really worked over this, defender of the Clinton team to try to find out on what possible basis could this uranium deal be justified. I think Tucker was left unsatisfied, as was I. I'm so struck that at the moment, Richard Pollack, that we've seen so much falderal about Donald Trump and the allegations of collusion on his part, that there's been such a propensity, and frankly, in fairness, not just on the part of Democrats, but Republicans as well. I think Ron DeSantis, congressman from Florida, said yesterday that the Republican leadership in the last Congress didn't want to investigate these sorts of issues as they related to Hillary Clinton. It's mind-boggling. And again, thank God for the work that you and your colleagues at the Daily Caller and a few other institutions in the press have been doing to provide a measure of oversight that, and let me say judicial watch as well, that has been manifestly lacking on the part of the Congress. One of the other pieces of this, Richard, which I'd like to get your thoughts on, is that in a number of these instances, the sale of the uranium, this so-called ghost story, spy ring, perhaps the Podesta business as well. There has been awareness, it appears, on the part of the FBI and therefore the Justice Department of what was going on. And yet that information seems to have been suppressed. Hillary Clinton successfully managed to deport almost immediately the spies that were evidently trying to penetrate her circle. What do we make of the roles Mueller, Comey, Rosenstein, McCabe, and the like have played in enabling, in a sense, this scandal to go forward?
Well, first of all, Washington is a Democratic city. It's heavily Democratic, and most of the governmental bureaucracy is very liberal and very much in the corner of the Democratic Party. I remember seeing a report recently, about 98% of career employees at the federal government support Democrats, and so they have Mueller, who is a revolving door kind of guy. Once was a former director of the FBI. When you have a variety of other people who are partisan and pursuing partisan politics as opposed to getting to the truth of any kind of wrongdoing, it doesn't surprise one. And this is a serious problem when the president wants to seek some sort of an investigation. I mean, he's tweeted out that there should be investigations, but it's really unclear whether it's going to happen or not.
Well, and meanwhile, he himself is being investigated by these same characters who have, at the very least, it would seem to me, conducted themselves in a manner that is subject to investigation in its own right. we won't get into the fact that most of the press corps has a similar kind of proclivity, doesn't it? But thank you, Richard Pollack, for, again, the work that you're doing in your part of the press corps and that of the Daily Caller, which you represent so well. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon with continuing updates. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman about some of the chickens coming home to roost he's been warning about for quite some time. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with one of the country's preeminent experts on economic warfare. He is, of course, Kevin Freeman, a chartered financial analyst turned maven on these issues of those who are waging economic warfare against us, how they are doing it, and what we can do about it. He is the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. You can follow his writings and work at globaleconomicwarfare.com, and he is the star of the forthcoming show on television, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. We're glad to have Kevin Freeman with us. Welcome back, Kevin. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. Always good to be here.
You made a post recently, Kevin, that just sort of summarized in very short form, but pretty compellingly, a number of issues that you've been warning about for some time. We've talked about them off and on over the past year or two, and I'd like to just sort of recap on them and give our audience an update. Let's start with the topic we were discussing a moment ago with Richard Pollack, namely the latest evidence of Russian efforts to undermine the U.S. and how they manifested themselves not so much during the campaign of 2016 or the Trump candidacy, at least, and transition, but the Clinton and Obama administration. What about that?
Well, you know, The Hill has done a tremendous piece on this, and they tied together a lot of sources. And of course, Secretary Clinton called it a vast right-wing conspiracy. The Hill has pretty much nailed it. And Russia has been involved with the Clintons for years. It dates back to the Uranium One scandal and even before that. In fact, I personally have an experience where I was invited by Renaissance Capital back in 2006. But this is the same firm that paid Bill Clinton $500,000 right at the time that they were catching the Russian spy ring in the United States, right at the time that we were giving away 20% of our uranium to Russia. Right at the time Secretary Clinton was getting literally paid through the foundation to support their plans.
Yeah, $145 million, we're told, no less. And Kevin Freeman, you alluded to the spy ring, the so-called ghost story. We had our friend Michael Waller on the program yesterday talking about that saga. And I think it's worth just reminding our audience that the target of that so-called illegals ring, and if you want to know what that means, watch the television program The Americans. But these were deep cover operatives of the Kremlin who were apparently targeting the Clinton circle, including, by the way, Senator Chuck Schumer as well. And it just reeks of collusion. And I think, in addition, the fact that so many of the people now chasing the will of the wisp of Trump alleged collusion are some figures who were aware of the suppression of information about this behavior on the part of the Clintons, namely Robert Mueller, James Comey, Andrew McCabe, deputy director of the FBI, and Rod Rosenstein, now the deputy attorney general. It truly is out of the plot of television movie or thriller.
And the idea that these 10 spies, we caught them, and within hours, they were back home in Russia.
this is just incomprehensible. I was with the FBI in 2010 when this all took place. I was briefing them on economic warfare, and none of the agents that I talked to could even fathom the idea that we would catch a spy with this much information about what Russia was doing in our country and let them go that quickly. If we want to know what happened, it's the fault of the Obama administration and Secretary Clinton for sending those spies back home.
I don't know if it would explain everything, but it certainly would have explained something. And the fact that it had to be done so quickly surely smacks of a cover-up by the Clinton team. Let me turn quickly to North Korea, Kevin Freeman. This is another of the issues you've been warning about for quite some time. We have been learning about not only its capacity, certainly its desire to use electromagnetic pulse attacks against us, but also its increasing cyber capabilities. Give us your current view of the magnitude of the danger we face from that regime in Pyongyang.
Well, you know, when North Korea hacked Sony Pictures, and they did it because there was a movie coming out that the supreme whatever he is in North Korea, Kim Jong-un, did not like. So they hacked Sony Pictures and threatened them. The world said there's no way. North Korea is not that sophisticated. They couldn't pull it off and so forth. Actually, we knew better. And my intelligence contacts told me it was absolutely North Korea. There's no doubt. Well, the New York Times just about a week ago published "The World Once Laughed at North Korean Cyber Power. No more." We can't laugh because they've not only hacked millions of dollars, $81 million from the SWIFT banking transaction system, but they've been involved in some of the most sophisticated hacking operations using contacts that they have in China and otherwise. They've been very, very effective, and they are a threat to every company and every nation on the planet.
Yeah. And among other things, our electric grid, which I know you've been spending a lot of time worrying about as well. Also about our financial markets, Kevin, and there's new indications that the markets and for that matter, the Pentagon are beginning to really be concerned about cyber threats.
Well, you know, when I first started in 2008, warning that our financial markets could be under attack, almost no one in the Pentagon understood any of it. And frankly, they didn't believe it was even imaginable, not even possible. But there is an article was written just again last week or so from Wall Street Journal, where DARPA is focused on finding some solutions. How do we protect our financial markets?
Now, it's again the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, very critical part of the Defense Department's forward-looking capabilities.
Well, and they've just recognized that our critical infrastructure is where you attack America. If you don't want to have a direct military conflict, you attack the infrastructure, whether it's the power grid or the stock exchange or any of the other critical infrastructures. And we've seen all of them attacked at one time or another. We have to shore up our infrastructure, and the stock market is a big part of that.
And Kevin Freeman, finally, there is fresh evidence, it seems, of something else you've been concerned about. We've discussed at some length, and that is China's efforts. The Russians and others seem to be involved, but particularly now China seems to be swinging into a serious campaign to displace or otherwise reduce the importance of the dollar. De-dollarization by the Chinese, particularly in the oil sector. Your latest insights on that?
Well, it's happening regularly, and Wall Street's finally woken up to it and said, but why would China want to de-dollarize? The reason is it's an act of economic warfare. But one of the things they're doing is they're looking at purchasing the Saudi Aramco, the 5% that they want to sell. There's not a big appetite for it in London. There may not be a big appetite for it in New York. And so the Chinese have stepped up and said, we might just take that whole position for $100 billion. But in exchange, you'll remove using the dollar as the global reserve currency. You'll remove using the dollar for petrodollars, and more specifically for trading oil for a currency. They won't take dollars any longer. That would be a huge move. It would reverse something that happened in the 1970s that put the dollar in the strongest position, strongest currency in the world. And the Chinese are ready to pull that trigger. So we'll watch carefully to see how that unfolds.
We will also be checking with you in the weeks to come at globaleconomicwarfare.com for your recommendations as to how we can prevent that from happening, with very, very ominous implications for our financial well-being, and for that matter, I believe, the national security. Thank you, as always, for your great work. Senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and founder of GlobalEconomicWarfare.com. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with veteran Dan Perkins, a brilliant author, among other things, about condolences to the fallen and their families and the dangers emerging in Africa and beyond from the Sharia supremacists. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say joined by Dan Perkins, a man that I have come to know a little and admire greatly for not only the service to our country that he rendered in uniform, but also what he has done since he took it off in the financial sphere, but most especially in the literary one. He is a multiple-time best-selling author, including a series surrounding the topic of the Brotherhood of the Red Nile. He has a forthcoming book, Ted Baker, in Terrorist Gold. He's also the author of two books for children, Peter, the Little Irish Seal, and a new book just coming out shortly, Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? Dan Perkins, thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us. It's great to have you back.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
Let me ask you, Dan, I know you, as a former serviceman yourself, have been giving a lot of thought to the controversy that has been swirling of late about this issue of how officials in our government should properly express their condolences to the bereaved, those who've lost in the line of duty or in the service to their country, our servicemen, our police officers, and the like. This has, of course, become a particular controversy with Donald Trump and these soldiers who lost their lives in Niger. What would you recommend, and how should we be thinking about this?
First of all, I think congressmen, especially congresswomen who wear cowboy hats and are trying to be Maxine Waters wannabes, should probably shut their mouth. When I went into basic training, I volunteered. In fact, we had an all-volunteer army and still have a volunteer army. And when we stood in front of the barracks in our first day of basic training, we took an oath of allegiance to the flag and to the country and to defend the people, whatever the cost. I just think it's outrageous that a person who apparently never served in the military has no idea what it is to be part of a band of brothers. We have about 27 million veterans in the United States out of 325 million people. So it's a very small percentage of us. And our relationship with our fellow soldiers is extremely special. And what this congresswoman has done is politicized the act of a soldier, full well knowing when he took the oath of his office as a soldier that he was putting his life on the line. To turn it into a political event, I thought General Kelly did it best when he came in. He said today he came in and he heard about what she was doing. He was brokenhearted that the one thing left in his life was the peace and the honor and dignity for American soldiers who died in the line of battle have now become a political operative. And he said that just shouldn't happen. And I agree. And I think she was out of line. When Mr. Trump said he knew what he was doing, he absolutely knew. And that's, you talk to anybody who's been in the military, he knows. I remember I was called up in a reserve unit in Columbus, Ohio, when Martin Luther King was shot. And I was patrolling the streets of Columbus, Ohio with an M14 rifle loaded to protect infrastructure, given orders to shoot if attacked. In my own hometown, I was riding around in a quarter-ton Jeep on patrol. So I understand the risk that I was taking. And when they called us up to protect the city, I realized at that point in time, and we all talked about it in the barracks, that we could be killed. But we made the decision to do that. And if you look at the other Gold Star family who've come out and released recordings of the phone calls with President Trump and his compassion and his concern for them and their well-being, she's just out of line. And I think she's disrespectful to the men and women of our military, and most especially to the spouses of soldiers who've given their life for the country.
Thank you for being so clear on that. Congresswoman Federica Wilson, of course, is the woman in question who has precipitated this controversy. Let me ask you about the place where these men lost their lives, again, in the service of our country, Dan Perkins. It's a country called Niger in Africa. For most of us, Africa is not much on our minds. We have, however, reason to fear, I'm afraid, that we will find ourselves increasingly facing threats from that continent. Would you talk a little bit about what you see going on there? You've written, as I mentioned, a terrific book, The Brotherhood of the Red Nile, of course, very much an Africa-centered novel. What are we facing now in terms of specifically this sort of Sharia supremacist insurgency on the continent and perhaps beyond?
Well, I think that's a really good question. There's a lot of ways we can go with it. First of all, I've been doing a lot of interviews in the last week to 10 days since the former capital of the ISIL was taken. Well, and if you look at it, I'm not sure I'd want it after you see what physically happened to it. And I think that the people who are talking about, well, have we defeated ISIS, what they say, only in Syria and Iraq. Yeah, but they left a long time ago. What are we doing about the 32 nations around the world that are controlled ostensibly by radical Islamic leaders? What are we and Europe doing about the influx and the power struggle in most European countries between the Muslims who want to make Sharia law of the land, and the non-Muslims who are living with political correctness and don't realize that their nations are literally being subdivided because of the no-go zones and the allocation of resources and space to create an independent state within France, for example. All these places that are no-go zones are, in essence, subdivisions of the country controlled by the Muslims, and they're going to continue to do that, and they're going to take the countries apart. What's happening, that's happening all over the world, because most people do not understand that under Sharia law, Muslims, true believers, are forbidden to assimilate with Christians and Jews. So they set up their own fiefdoms within these countries and work to aggressively take over the countries and make them Muslim countries. So what you have is, in Africa, an extension of the growth of the Muslim faith and the tenets of Muhammad and Allah that are being spread all over the world. So it's interesting to talk about Syria and Iraq, but nobody's talking about what can we do in Europe, what can we do in the Far East where they're dominant. I mean, they're 1.3 billion of the world's population are Muslims.
Yeah, some say as much as 1.6. Yeah. Whatever the number is, a significant proportion of them, as you know, Dan Perkins, do adhere to this Sharia doctrine. Not all of them, but plenty. And they are on the march. And this brings us back just to momentarily for the closing thought. In places like Niger, in places like Sudan, in places like Somalia, of course, and Kenya and elsewhere, we're watching this insurgency, whether it's under the brand of the Islamic State or it's under some other rubric, doing exactly what you're talking about, as well, and we'll be talking momentarily with Ingrid Carlquist in Sweden about your other point, that it's in the Western world as well. This is a threat, an existential threat of our time, it seems, and we may well lose a lot more men and women in uniform, and probably a lot of others of us as well, before this is finally, hopefully, settled satisfactorily.
I agree with you. When I was writing the book, the trilogy, and even with Terrorist Gold, one of the research pieces that I did all the time, months and months and months and months and months, is look at the border crossings from Mexico into the United States under the Obama administration. And a couple of things kept coming across that I couldn't figure out, still can't figure out. The number of people coming from sub-Sahara Africa through the Mexican border into the United States, the Middle Eastern people who are coming to the United States through the Mexican border, we need to be concerned about them already in our country, as they took advantage of the open border policy of Barack Obama to just walk across the border.
among other ways they've gotten here. You're absolutely right. Dan Perkins, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I do hope we'll have a chance to visit with you again very soon. Thank you so much for your extraordinary contributions to our thinking on so many of these issues, both through your literature and your public speaking and interviews like this. Again, thank you for your time today. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, as promised, Ingrid Carlquist joins us. We'll talk with her about Farewell to Sweden and A Warning to America. That and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, it is a pleasure to say, joined by Ingrid Carlquist, a courageous and highly skilled freelance journalist and author. She is currently working on a new book with the working title, From Sweden to Absurdistan. And we're going to take stock with Ingrid about what is becoming to Sweden, her native land that is not simply absurd, but appalling and indeed alarming. Ingrid Carlquist, thank you so much for finding a few minutes to talk with us. It's good to visit.
Yeah, it's nice to be back.
Let me ask you first, just to sort of level set on what you are seeing around you at the moment. The chief of the National Police Service a few months ago made what was a stunning appeal for help to those in Sweden who are not interested in having the country go down the tubes, I guess, my words, not his, but in part motivated by the fact that enormous numbers of his men in uniform, I guess, and women as well, have decided to resign rather than continue to try to provide security in an increasingly difficult situation in Sweden. Is all that correct? And if so, what is the source of the problem?
It is correct. There are so many police officers quitting their job every week. And it's because of two things. Firstly, they have quite bad salaries, but I think they could cope with that if they felt that they had the support from the chief of police. You know, what is happening in Sweden and has been going on for at least 10 or 15 years is that nobody has been doing anything about these so-called exclusion areas, what I call no-go zones. They have become no-go zones. But, you know, the police won't take that word in their mouth, and the government certainly will not. But that is correct. I mean, if the ambulance can't go in there without having police escort, then it's a no-go zone. If they had taken, if they had done something 10 or 15 years ago, then we might not have been in this situation. But they thought, no, we can't do that, because if the Swedes see that there are some problems in these areas where there live mostly Muslim immigrants, then they might be racist. So they just, you know, they held their breath thinking that maybe it will solve itself. But, you know, these things never do.
They don't seem to. In fact, what has been happening, as I understand it, Ingrid Carlquist, is that the situation has become more and more egregious, and not just in those so-called exclusion zones, or I think you're absolutely right, let's call them what they are, no-go zones, areas that the authorities are fearful to enter. There has been reports that Sweden is now the rape capital of Europe. This is, again, something that was, if not unknown, certainly not a problem in the pre-migration surge period, as I understand it. Again, correct me if I'm wrong about that, but how egregious is this problem at the moment in Sweden, in its prisons as well as on the streets?
Well, it is a big problem. And just as you say, the rapes are not only going on in the no-go zones, but, you know, Swedish women are being attacked in the parks and when they're out running in the, you know, exercising and so on. And unfortunately, too, we have a lot of young girls who have been brainwashed that there are no such thing as differences between people. So they think that if they don't go to you know, with an Afghani boy home, for example, to have a cup of tea. If she doesn't do that, thinking that he might harm her, then she's a racist. Swedish girls and women, they don't take care of themselves because they have been taught that everybody is the same. So before, we could go with Swedish guys because they're fairly nice. And you could tell them, I just want to drink tea. And he will be a little disappointed, but he will say, okay, that's fine. It goes both ways, so to speak. But I mean, we know that, for example, Afghanistan is the most dangerous country in the world for women. So why do you think that when you bring Afghani men to Sweden, that they will suddenly become like Swedish men?
Assimilating and embracing the superior culture of the West, not if they believe that, in fact, it is Allah's will that they will actually impose their culture. How about evidence that there's an extraordinary thing happening in terms of indoctrination? You mentioned the sort of multiculturalism and diversity sensitivity and all of that, but there actually seems to be in Sweden these days, according to reports I've seen, Ingrid Carlquist, a fair amount of just outright Islamist or Sharia propaganda being insinuated into textbooks and school curricula. Is that in fact happening too?
It is. I have seen, you know, school books in religion, for example, where they say the most extraordinary things about Islam, how it is the religion of peace. They never bring up anything about what's the problem with Islam. So how can they know? Well, they can know by watching the news, because even though the journalist might want to hide all the facts, they are not able to do it. And of course, I think many of them, they notice that they have Muslim friends in school or schoolmates. So they see that they are very much more aggressive. And I think the Swedish boys, they do have a problem because they have been brainwashed with feminism, real leftist feminism. So they think that they are not allowed to get into a fight, to, you know, say to someone, stop or I will punch you. Because that would be sexist and misogynist and racist and all the things that you can think of. So the Swedish boys, they just walk away.
And this unfortunately reinforces the entire sort of doctrinal DNA of Sharia, which says, well, when you see submission on the part of the kufr, the infidel, you must respond to it by, you know, making them feel subdued. So it just brings about even more aggressive and ultimately dangerous behavior. Lastly, and very quickly, we are now confronting something that I know you personally have been wrestling with, as have many, many others in Sweden and indeed throughout Europe increasingly, and that is restrictions on freedom of speech. You've talked about the kinds of norms that the society has been imposing. Talk, if you would, now about how that's translating into, if not actually the silencing of people like yourself who are making these astute and necessary observations, but certainly discouraging that self-censorship at the minimum.
It's a really bad situation. And I think all the Swedish journalists, I'm sorry to say, and politicians and leftists, they don't even know what freedom of speech is anymore. They think that freedom of speech is for those who have the right opinions. And it's actually the opposite, of course, you know that. I can hate something like National Socialism, but I still want them to have their freedom of speech. Because if we don't let them have freedom of speech, who will be next in line? And now they're actually talking here to forbid this National Socialist Party. You know, they want to forbid it. All the other parties, even the Sweden Democrats. And what about me? I have my podcast that I do every day talking about news since, you know, I'm a journalist. I can help people to deconstruct what the papers are writing. And now they are trying to shut me down by saying that I need a publisher. We have this law in Sweden saying you have to have a responsible publisher. I mean, this law was before the internet. But even so, the Chancellor of Justice is now actually thinking about prosecuting me for not handing in myself as a publisher.
Oh, Ingrid Carlquist, this is heartbreaking and such a cautionary tale. Each of the things that we've talked about, the exclusion zones, the rape and other sexual and other forms of aggressiveness, the textbooks being turned into incubators for Sharia supremacism and the curbing of freedom of speech on the part of people like yourself, journalists even, is something I fear is very much in our future as well. I appreciate so much your time today and your courage. As I say, I hope you will keep it up and be well and come back to us again very soon. Thank you, Ingrid.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.